Track up, please. Da 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 da.
Hello and welcome to the Point Blank Show. My name is Abhishek. Today I have with me Kenneth Miller, the author of Mapping the Darkness, the visionary scientists who unlock the mysteries of sleep. His fascinating work shines a spotlight on a subject that only until half a century ago was quite a mystery. Thank you very much, Kenneth, for joining in on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Speaking of sleep, on which you've done this magnificent book, did you get enough sleep last night? Are you well rested? You are all the way in the US, it's early morning.
I confess that I did not get enough sleep last night. I was up late working on an article deadline. Got about 5.5 hours, which is nowhere near enough.
And what's that magic number? Is it 7 that you write about and is what all the doctors agree? Is that the number?
Well, on average, most people can get by with 7 to 9. Below 7 is when you start seeing statistical problems with higher risk of everything from cancer and diabetes to cardiovascular disease and dementia and things like that. But it's statistical and different individuals have different needs. I like to get at least 7.
And at the start of your book itself, you paint a picture which is a little grim to start with, and it did shake me up a bit because I don't have the most ideal sleep patterns myself. And you write about a story of a man who, you know, struggles to sleep and how getting a good night's sleep had become a matter of life and death. You write about a girl who suffered from a sleeping disorder, and for lack of oxygen getting to her brain, her IQ had shrunk to 75, whereas her brother somehow also had the same problem, miraculously had a little surgery and got things done. So getting a good night's sleep, how important is that?
Well, it really can be a matter of life and death. And I became aware of this because this whole book project started with an assignment about 10 years ago for Discover Magazine on the latest breakthroughs in sleep science. I had never really thought that much about sleep. And what really got my attention was I met a guy who had a sleep-related breathing disorder. It was something like what we call obstructive sleep apnea, but a little bit less easy to diagnose, a little bit subtler. And this guy had been a successful radiologist. He had 2 medical practices. He played a great game of tennis. And in his 40s, he started losing his memory and losing his ability to concentrate. And slowly, his body started breaking down as well. He couldn't get up from a chair without being short of breath. As a doctor, he knew that it was some kind of sleep, or he suspected it was some kind of sleep disorder. At first, he thought it might be Alzheimer's disease, but sleep specialists, it took them years to diagnose him. And during that time, he had to give up parts of his professional life. His marriage fell apart. He wound up one day in the shower just collapsing in tears, dried himself off, and went looking for the best sleep specialist he could find, who was able to diagnose him. But it really did affect his life in such a profound way. And that's part of what got me so excited about this topic.
And I find it surprising. I don't know how it is in the US, but when we go to physicians, let's say there's a little bit of fever and I visit my doctor, not once or very rarely do they ask about, are you getting enough sleep? It is all about diet, exercise, but not so much about sleep. Is it a peculiar thing in India, you think, or generally it doesn't get enough stress as much as it demands?
I think it's very common, actually. I know that in the United States, physicians generally get very little training in sleep over the course of their medical school career. It might be a couple of hours. You know, there's plenty of information out there, but I think that most doctors really aren't sufficiently aware. And part of my intention with the book is to really raise awareness of that.
And you also focus in 11 chapters around the circadian rhythm, if I'm pronouncing that right, where
yes.
What does it do to the body? What is that 24-hour cycle? If you could explain to somebody as if I were a 5-year-old of sorts.
Sure. Well, for a long time, there was debate over whether human beings really had an internal biological clock. Were our sleep-wake schedules dictated just by our decisions and our habits, or was there something biological operating that really made us need to sleep and wake on a certain schedule? In the 1920s, some researchers started finding a little bit of evidence for it, but really, what really proved it was in the early 1970s when researchers found a center in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, that acts as a sort of a master clock for the body's daily rhythms. What these daily rhythms are called technically is circadian rhythms, and the word circadian is taken from, I think, the Latin, which means about a day, which means they last about 24 hours. For some people, they might be slightly shorter. For some people, they might be longer. But these things are really genetically programmed. They're set by our brains. And our bodies, all of our cells have those little clocks too. And so the idea is that sleep and waking is one of many different circadian rhythms. And if you don't sleep and wake on a regular, healthy schedule, all those other rhythms can get thrown out of sync as well, and you can have all sorts of medical problems.
And also the mood itself is determined by this rhythm, isn't it? It is said that it doesn't matter what time you sleep, but it is recommended that we as human beings wake up at a same time every day. Is that correct? And that's very important for us to set a routine, which is what all psychologists also talk about. If you don't have a routine in life, you might be a little more disoriented in getting things done.
Yes, this is also very important for mood, for cognitive clarity, for memory and learning, for ability to focus, all of those things. Sleep helps regulate all those things. And yes, the reason that getting up early at the same time is important is that what sets that circadian clock in your brain is mostly intense light. People were, evolved to survive in a 24-hour day dictated by sunrise and sunset. And so the way your circadian system knows what time it is if you get bright sunlight in the morning. And so you wake up at the same time, you get a blast of sunlight by going outside because artificial light can never be as intense as what you get even on a cloudy day outside. And that helps your brain know what time it is, and it helps you fall asleep when you want to, when evening comes.
So take us back to the time that scientists back then tried to do some of the studies that you have covered so eloquently in your book about the artificial light or natural light. One of the most fascinating ones, and I'm sure people ask you this more often than most, is that of Mr. Clitman, Nathaniel Clitman, the famous scientist who decided to go pack his bags up with his colleague and go live in a cave for a month to understand the whole concept of sleep. What was that about, and how did he go about it?
Really, most of human history, sleep was not really a matter for scientists. Sleep was it was a mystical experience. You would go to sleep and you would communicate with the gods or the spirits. You would travel back and forward in time. All sorts of stuff was going on that was really spiritual. But during the Industrial Revolution, things changed because, factories needed to be there at a certain time, and factory owners wanted to know what amount and what timing of sleep people needed to remain healthy. And so scientists began in the mid-19th century to study the basic facts about sleep. How much do we need? What are the rhythms? How do our bodies behave during this time? But nobody thought it was interesting enough to do it full time. And in the 1920s, Nathaniel Clitman, who was a refugee from Tsarist Russia, made his way first to the United States and then to the University of Chicago, wherein he started his PhD studies. Interestingly, there's a sociological aspect to this. Anti-Semitism was rife in those days. He was Jewish. He had left Russia because of persecution. He arrived in the United States and found prejudice. And for scientists in those days, Jewish scientists, if you wanted to become a researcher, you had to find a new field that wasn't already dominated by others. And Clitman learned about sleep science. Only a little bit had been done. And he said to his PhD advisor, "I want to be the first person in the world to do this full time." That's how he got started. So in 1925, he launched the world's first dedicated sleep laboratory at the University of Chicago. The thing that really fascinated Clitman to begin with was the rhythms of sleep. Is that 24-hour sleep-wake cycle, can it be changed? And if it was changed, how much can it be changed? And if it's changed too much, or what effect does that have on human health? So he started doing experiments where he and his students would stay up they would try to reset their clocks to a different schedule, maybe 12 hours between sleeping and waking, maybe 48 hours between sleeping and waking. And they found that anything beyond 21 to 28 hours was very hard for the body to adjust to. In fact, it was impossible for the body to adjust to. And the way they measured that was by daily temperature fluctuations. Because in normal circumstances, your body temperature fluctuates by 1 or 2 degrees, reaching a high in the late afternoon, early evening, and a low in the very early morning after midnight. Kleitman started experimenting with this. He found that some of his students could adjust to a 28-hour day, but he couldn't. He wondered why this was. Was it because he was older? Was it because maybe he was more sensitive to external cues of sunrise and sunset than they were, of the day getting warmer during the day and cooler at night? He wanted to find out. So his first idea was to try to find a way to isolate himself from those cues. And he thought, maybe I'll go to the Arctic during the summertime when it's 24-hour daylight and see if I can adjust my schedule that way in the absence of cues. But it was the middle of the Great Depression. It was 1938. He found out he didn't have the money. But a colleague suggested to him, why don't you try a cave? In fact, there's this great cave, the biggest one in North America, called Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. And you could go down there, spend a month, and see what you can do to your sleep-wake cycle. So that's what he did. He took an assistant, and he spent a month in Mammoth Cave trying to adjust both of their sleep-wake cycles to a 28-hour rhythm. The results of the experiment were inconclusive. Kleitman couldn't adjust. His assistant did okay. He couldn't really make any conclusions from that, but what happened during that experiment was very important. The press got wind of it. Reporters started showing up in the cave. It became a media sensation with front page headlines, newsreels in all the movie theaters across America. And when Kleitman emerged from the cave, he was a celebrity. And for the first time, the public was really aware of sleep science. And that really helped the field, helped jumpstart the field.
Ironically, he did not want all the attention, but then I think it did well for the subject of sleep science itself, because it was surprising that we sleep nearly a third or less of our lives if we get good sleep. But until a century ago, you write that only a handful of scientists studied sleep. You also write that, you know, industrial revolution changed that. Is that correct? Where the alarm clocks came in?
Yes, the alarm clocks came in, and a very important thing that happened once people were no longer following that natural cycle of sunrise and sunset was they started having something that came to be called insomnia. Before that, people often had trouble sleeping, but it was because they slept on incredibly uncomfortable straw mattresses, because they had bed bugs and lice, all that other stuff that was very common around the world. But with the Industrial Revolution, a different thing started happening. People might have comfortable beds in nice buildings, but they found themselves unable to sleep because they were becoming divorced from their body's natural rhythms, and because there was so much stimulus going on with modern life that this started becoming a public health problem. And this was a big reason why sleep science got started. The problem was that because very little was known about how sleep worked, a lot of experts thought it wasn't really necessary, or people slept too much. If you tried hard enough, if you were disciplined enough, they thought, you could minimize it. There was one famous psychologist who theorized that if you just cut back on sleep for 5 minutes a night over a period of years, you could eliminate it altogether. And he thought that would be a very good thing. So famous industrialists would brag that they could get by with 4 hours of sleep, and everyone else should too. So it really took this scientific investigation to win respect for sleep and help people understand how incredibly necessary it is.
But even then, we boast about it today as well, right? That there are people who say, hey, I get by, I just need 4 hours of sleep. I just need 5 hours, I'll get by. The superstars, actors, industrialists that you said, that's not a good thing to brag about in hindsight then, because it's not helping anybody beyond a point, or at least that person who's talking about it. Is that correct?
It is correct. And, you know, some people are genetically programmed to need less, but it's quite a tiny sliver of the population. Some people need much more. Some people need 10 to 12 hours. However, it's not the case that the more sleep you get, the healthier you are either, because beyond 8 or 9 hours, people actually, the correlations start being that people who get over 9 or 10 hours a night tend to be less healthy. We don't know if that's because they're sleeping too much or they're sleeping too much because they have health problems, but statistically speaking, 7 to 9 is pretty much the sweet spot.
And those who can't get a shut-eye on their own, there are, you know, prescribed sleeping pills. And I read in your book that by 1930, an estimated 1 billion doses of barbiturates, that is the sleep aids, which touted themselves to be better than the predecessors, were already being meted out. Recently, I was hearing an interview of Dele Alli, who's a Premier League footballer, plays for England, or did for a while. He talked about how even footballers are given sleeping pills before a big match so that they can calm themselves down, because there is a lot of adrenaline going in there. So how does it all work? You know, some, is it an occupational hazard for some? How does it help or hinder our rhythm, or neurologically speaking as well?
Well, sleep medications have been around since the 1860s was when the first synthetic sleep medication was invented, chloral hydrate. And the early ones were very dangerous. They were very easy to overdose on. They were habit-forming. They brought all sorts of other health problems. And in 1903, barbiturates were introduced. They were supposed to be better, but they also turned out to be highly addictive. You had to take more and more of them to get the effects, and people were dying quite commonly from taking these things, and they'd be zoned out. You know, they were terrible, really. In the 1950s, the minor tranquilizers started showing up, and then the benzodiazepines in the 60s. The benzodiazepines were supposed to be better than the barbiturates, but the benzodiazepines had their own problems. They were they caused psychological dependency. You could, if you had them with alcohol or other drugs, you could still overdose on them. People were spaced out during the day from taking them. So the search for a good sleeping pill has been going on since the 1860s. More recently, there have been other formulations, the Z drugs like Ambien, and I don't know what they're called in India, but new formulations that are kind of like the benzodiazepines, but they're tweaked slightly. But they bring their own problems. Some people have found themselves driving while asleep, eating while asleep, having sex while asleep from the Z drugs. Later than that came what they call the orexin inhibitors, which are drugs that work with a completely different brain system. And these seem to work a bit better with maybe fewer problems. However, some people experience depression. Some people have other problems with them, and they don't work for everybody. So sleeping pills are very imperfect, and the kind of sleep you get on them tends to be a little different from natural sleep. Your sleep stages might have different proportions. Your brain waves don't look exactly the same. Nobody's exactly sure what the import of that is. But the idea is that sleep medications are really not a panacea. They can bring additional problems to the ones you already had, especially when taken over the long term. So first of all, it's very important to consult carefully with your doctor before starting on these things. Second of all, it's really not a good idea to take any of them for a really long period unless your doctor says, look, you have no other choice. But starting in the 1970s, and really by the 1990s, several non-pharmaceutical techniques had emerged. Researchers were coming up with, because they were discovering that sleep is not just a physical thing. It's not just a psychological thing. Good sleep really depends on a balance of both. Anxiety can interfere with your sleep. Thought patterns can interfere with your sleep. Physical overstimulation can interfere with your sleep. And scientists started realizing that if we attack those problems, we might be able to break the vicious circle of people lying in bed thinking, when am I going to fall asleep? When am I going to fall asleep? And then not being able to fall asleep because they're so anxious about that and how they're going to be the next day and the things that have happened to them all day. So there's a technique that combines several other non-pharmaceutical techniques that's called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. That's CBTI is the abbreviation we use. That has been shown to be, over the long term, for most people, as effective as sleeping pills, but has no side effects. And this is pretty easy to access online. It's pretty easy to access with a psychotherapist in your area. And this is something that experts are now recommending for the majority of people with long-term insomnia.
Interesting. You talked about the kind of sleep that is induced through these sleeping pills. It may be different from your natural sleep. I think I read somewhere, I think it was Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, the neuroscientist, I think, where he talked a little bit about how it might knock you out a sleeping pill, or maybe you've gotten drunk and you're on the couch, but you may not actually be sleeping. The sleep centers are still, you know, not doing their bit. It's something else, maybe the prefrontal cortex or some such, it gets knocked out, but that's not the quality of sleep that you want then.
Absolutely right. And, you know, alternatives to sleeping pills, a lot of people do use alcohol to try to sleep. And alcohol, again, does not give you a really good sleep. It may make it easier for you to fall asleep at the beginning of the night. Again, it knocks you out. But because of the way it affects your brain and your temperature cycles, very often you'll wake up in the middle of the night, you'll be restless, your sleep will be disturbed, and so alcohol is really not a good solution either. And there are also herbal things some people take. Herbal teas can calm you down. They're not really a solution, but a lot of people now are taking melatonin, which is a hormone and neurotransmitter that's associated with sleep. Your melatonin levels generally start building up towards nightfall. They drop towards morning. Melatonin can help make you sleepy. It's very much a crucial chemical component of the sleeping process. Some people can take melatonin capsules and it helps them. Many other people take it and it doesn't, but melatonin capsules that you find in your drugstore, your grocery store, the problem is they're not really regulated, and so it's hard to tell what dosage you're actually getting. Because it's a hormone and a neurotransmitter, it's not quite clear what effects it might be having on your other bodily systems. So the general advice on melatonin is, if it works for you, you can keep taking it. But if it doesn't, there are many other alternatives.
In terms of the modern life of an individual, which is infested with smartphones, and you know, you want to check your email or social media before you go to bed. That's become the new norm, and more so in the last 5-7 years than ever before. How does that impact just before hitting the bed, when you are looking at that screen and then you go to bed? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I can say it's not an ideal thing. There is some debate over the effect of looking at our smartphones and our tablets at night. One theory is that they emit blue light. And blue light is what, in normal circumstances, in nature, you would see in the morning. And so when you're looking at a screen that's beaming blue light into your eyes, it's going to that brain center called the suprachiasmatic nucleus and telling it, hey, it's morning, wake up. So that can disrupt your sleep. Now, there's some debate over whether it's the blue light from the screens or just the bright light beaming into your eyes from the screens that might do that, and how much of an effect it has. We're still in very early days of figuring that stuff out, but it seems to make sense. Another thing about looking at your screens simply is that they're emotionally and mentally stimulating. And if you're on social media, you might be having your feelings of anxiety, envy, whatever sort of stimulated right before you're trying to go to bed. That's not particularly good for you either. So most experts at this point advise people to try to get off of your screens a couple of hours before you go to bed. The science is not conclusive, but it seems like a smart idea.
Yeah, those thought patterns that you talk about, right? You don't want anything to interfere with your sleep. And you have an amusing little story in your book where Albert Einstein volunteers to get himself tested in the night. And then he goes into deep sleep and then suddenly wakes up and calls for a telephone, doesn't he? Where he says he's got some correction in some paper that he's written to his colleagues on the other side of the country. That comes in the way. So you want to have a sound sleep. You may as well keep everything away.
It's true, although that Einstein story also illustrates another thing. We don't know what Einstein was doing right before he went to bed at that point and why he woke up in the middle of the night. But I myself have experienced this, and I think many other people have, of waking up in the middle of the night. You've been working on a problem. For example, when I was writing this book, I would be writing a chapter. I'd get to a point, how do I go forward in this? I don't know what I'm doing, you know? Where am I going? Go to sleep. Wake up in the middle of the night, I've got it. And I would go to it. I kept a little pad of paper by my bed and I would write down the solution. And I'd wake up in the morning and think, my God, that was brilliant. Sometimes I would wake up I wouldn't wake up in the middle of the night, but I'd wake up in the morning having gone to bed with an insoluble problem. And in the morning, my brain would go, hey, here's the solution. So one thing that's happening in your brain during the night is it isn't continuing to solve your daytime problems. And that is another reason why sleep is so important, because memories are getting consolidated, things are being worked out on this subconscious level that you have no idea, and the next day you actually benefit from that with new ideas, with better ideas.
So would you recommend having a pen and paper next to you while you go to bed to just jot down if something comes to you?
Couldn't hurt.
Yes. I think wasn't there a scientist, or I don't know if this is a true story, where he dreamed the chemical composition of a compound? Maybe he saw somebody dancing in the... Was that what it was? I mean, people were ball dancing, and then he drew that. And I'm not exactly sure what the story is, but yeah, he solved his problem in his sleep.
Yes, it's true. As I recall, that was benzene rings. And as a non-scientist, I'm not quite sure, you know, what those are. But it was a very important discovery. Musical composers have had themes come to them at night, which they then use in symphonies. I mean, sleep is very powerful in that way. And there really is something mystical about that process, you know. Scientists are still trying to figure out the neural pathways involved in sleep turn out to be incredibly complex. And this is one of the other things I found fascinating in the book, in researching the book, was that, you know, in the beginning, when scientists first started trying to figure out what is sleep all about, what makes it happen, they started with very simple ideas. So in the 19th century, the first idea was, well, we've observed sleeping animals, and we see that there's less blood flow on the surface of their brain. So maybe sleep is triggered by lack of blood flow in the brain. And some of the ancient Greeks even had this idea. But it turns out, no, it's not quite so simple. A little bit later in the 19th century, scientists started, they had learned that in studying muscular activity, they found that a buildup of waste products in a muscle could cause the muscle to stop working, and the muscle had to clear out the chemicals before it could work. They thought maybe something like that is happening in the brain too. Maybe it's the buildup of what they called a hypnotoxin. But they couldn't figure out what that chemical might be or how it might work. And over the decades and the decades, as scientists kept looking at this, they found that it's so much more complicated than anyone ever dreamed. It's different brain centers communicating in these incredibly complex feedback loops using cascades of neurochemicals that we're still trying to figure out. There's still debate over, for example, in REM sleep, what is REM sleep doing for our memory processes? What is slow wave sleep doing for our memory processes? It looks like during REM, possibly brain cells are trimming unnecessary connections, pruning unnecessary synapses, so that you don't remember too much unnecessary stuff from the previous day. That might include things like post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. There's some thought now that sleep dysregulation has a role in that, that if you have a traumatic experience, your brain is unable to properly prune those neural connections, which would help you get over difficult situations that you experienced earlier, you know, in the previous day. And that you keep rehearsing those during the night while you're dreaming, that those connections get stronger and stronger, and that's why you can't shake the memories. And so there's some work now, some research being done into treating PTSD through enhancing different sleep stages to see if you can actually loosen up or prune those neural connections. So it's a very complex subject, and more is being learned about it all the time.
Yes, and you know, lack of sleep itself. How did you go about finding that piece where 1959, a New York disc jockey named Peter Tripp, I won't give away too much for the readers to, you know, pick up and read the story, but he decided to stay awake for 200 hours to contribute to the study of REM. REM is rapid eye movement sleep that you were talking about, to see what happens to the brain if you go for prolonged time without getting a shut eye.
Yes, and you know, sleep deprivation is a big part of how sleep research has been done over the years. One of the ways that scientists study any physiological phenomenon is to see what happens if you interrupt it or if you eliminate it. And so in the 1890s, the first scientist who did this with sleep was a Russian pioneering woman scientist named Maria Manasena. She had read that, you know, in in ancient China, one of the methods of torture was to deprive people of sleep, and people would die of that. And she said, I wonder if that's really true. And she decided to try that with dogs, with puppies, actually. She took 10 puppies and deprived them of sleep for a few days, and she found that they all died. Other experiments had shown that dogs could go without food for several weeks before they died, but with sleep, these dogs died within days. So that was a big clue that sleep was really vital. A little bit later, some scientists in the United States tried the same thing with people. You know, they didn't want to do it to the point of death, of course, but they found that when they deprived their medical students of sleep for a few days, all sorts of things started happening where they couldn't focus. They were having waking dreams. Their grip strength in their hands diminished. They put on weight. And so clearly there were all sorts of systems being affected by sleep deprivation. Nathaniel Kleitman, the founder of modern sleep science in the 1920s, started doing this in a more systematic way and measuring people's blood chemistry and their movements and their alertness and their mental performance and things like that when they went without sleep for 100 hours or more. He included himself in those experiments. And he found interesting things. One thing, of course, was that people just didn't perform well. He was experimenting on medical students. They would be taking notes in class, and after a few nights without sleep, they couldn't take legible notes. But he also found that when you go without sleep, your degree of sleepiness fluctuates throughout the day and changes over the course of several days in how much it fluctuates. And that became a clue much later for scientists studying circadian rhythms and the biological clock. It was a clue that these things are really running on some internal clockwork rather than just being a matter of habit and what people wanted to do.
Yeah, and those students that you talked about, when they were checking their own pulse, they couldn't keep count after 20 beats because they couldn't focus.
Right.
Drowsy driving, to bring that on the roads, that itself is a big problem, isn't it? I know at least two friends who had close shaves in the night because they fell asleep at the wheel. And apparently, according to one stat, road accidents due to drowsy driving far outnumber drunk driving, which is a pretty big hazard.
It truly is. And, you know, one of the things that inspired me to write this book, besides just the fascination of the material that I was looking into, was that around the time that I first wrote published my original sleep article in a magazine that got me interested in this, my father, who was 87 years old at the time, fell asleep at the wheel of his car and ran into a tree. He was badly injured. He fortunately survived, but that was the end of his ability to live independently. So that was also a very profound experience that helped me understand how important sleep is. The person who really found out about who really spearheaded the idea of sleep as a public health issue, not just an issue between you and your doctor, you and your spouse, was a guy named William Dement. William Dement was a student of Nathaniel Kleitman's, the founder of modern sleep science. Dement had worked in the laboratory where Kleitman's other famous student, Eugene Ossorinsky, discovered REM sleep. Eugene Ossorinsky left the field very quickly, but Dement thought, wow, REM sleep is incredibly interesting. He started studying it. That led him to get interested in sleep and health in general. And Dement founded the field of sleep medicine in the 1970s. Dement, while running his clinic, started noticing that sleep was not just a personal problem, it was a social problem. And part of the problem was that it was causing loads and loads of accidents. And what really awakened him and other scientists to this was in 1986, when the space shuttle Challenger exploded, and an investigative commission discovered that one of the reasons the accident happened was because the launch engineers at NASA had been sleep deprived for two consecutive nights, and their decision-making process was deeply impaired. That led to a bunch of studies showing, yes, that car crashes increase at certain hours when people are sleep deprived, that industrial accidents are more likely to occur when people are sleep deprived, including the Chernobyl and Three Mile Island meltdowns, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, all were sleep deprivation was involved in all of those things. And so one of the important things, my takeaways from this book, was that sleep is not just a personal problem, but it's a problem in society, causing excess car crashes, excess industrial disasters, all sorts of man-made disasters are actually affected by lack of sleep.
You write about another construction worker, don't you, where he would fall asleep on the scaffolding while, you know, doing his bit because he suffered from obstructive sleep apnea, where you wake up in the night because you're not breathing enough. So this is a real and present problem. And William Dement, you just talked about, he also, would he be the first person to have popularized sleep science because he was called on to the Johnny Carlson show, among other celebrities, where he was asked some pertinent questions. So on a late night comedy show, a sleep scientist for the first time, did it start getting serious back in the 1970s? I think that was 1974 is what you write.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dement had a few advantages. He was very sociable and he was very charismatic. And among the major sleep researchers, he was the first one who really was suitable to become a public figure. He was just a charming, exciting guy, full of enthusiasm. And so he was great on television and things like that. But Dement also wound up being a very serious leader in testifying before Congress, in awakening the public to the urgency of this situation. So yeah, Dement was absolutely a pivotal figure.
So I will ask you the same question that Johnny Carlson asked Mr. Dement back in the day. Why do people need to sleep? What answer do we have today, which is any different from 1974?
I think Dement's answer to Carson was exactly right, which was we sleep to avoid being sleepy. And that, you know, that got a laugh from the audience because it seems sort of silly. But in fact, no one knows why evolution programmed us to sleep in the first place. It's possible that it was to conserve energy so we wouldn't need as much food. It's possible, some scientists have theorized that, well, it was a way to force animals to hide from their predators at the hour when they would be most vulnerable, to keep them from falling off of cliffs in the middle of the night when they couldn't see, or a time when our brains are doing offline maintenance. All of these things, you know, have something to say for them, but nobody knows what the real reason is. But what we do know is if we don't get enough sleep, we are sleepy. And when we're sleepy, we really don't perform well. And our bodies also don't perform well. And so the importance of sleep is to avoid sleepiness.
Even birds, the migratory birds, even they catch a wink while in the air for a few seconds, and that's their bit of rest or whatever the reason is. If they don't do that, they might be a little too sleepy for their own comfort. What are your hacks, Kenneth, in terms of getting yourself to bed? What have you learned over the years? You're a journalist. You will have these deadlines which at odd hours. So how do you manage that? And are there any tips for those wanting to apply to sleep well?
Yes. Well, before I started researching sleep, I had terrible sleep habits because, yes, as you said, I'm a freelance journalist. I'd have deadlines. And someone had told me, or I read somewhere, that all you needed was 6 hours as a minimum. And so that's what I was trying to get by on. And strangely enough, I was irritable, forgetful, had trouble focusing a lot of the time. And I really didn't put those things together. And once I started researching this stuff, I realized, I better get more. And so the first thing is to just decide, I really need to work on this. This is important to my life. What can I do to make things better? I started for myself, you know, just trying to pull fewer all-nighters and make sure I got to bed by a certain time. But there are other things that you can do. The scientists say that, you know, preventing sleep problems is really the best cure. And ways to prevent them involve helping your circadian systems stay aligned with each other. And so probably the first key thing that all the experts say is you should try to keep regular hours if you possibly can, because that clock in your brain uses things like daylight to know what time it is. And if you keep irregular habits, you're going to make it confused. That's the first thing. Another thing that a lot of experts say is that exercise makes a big difference. Regular exercise. It's not that if you have a hard workout one day, that night you're going to have a great sleep, but it's developing regular exercise habits seems to help people sleep better. There's something going on involving the communication between the brain and the body there are all sorts of theories about what it is, but that's something that seems to work. Another thing is that your bed should be really only for sleeping and a few related things like, you know, sex and maybe some light reading that calms you down. But things like watching television in bed, doing work in bed, eating in bed are psychologically confusing. Your brain has a way of making associations with things, and if it associates your bed with sleeping, you're in good shape. If it associates your bed with working and being stimulated by television or your smartphone, not such a good thing. So that's a thing to avoid. Other things involve caffeinated beverages. You don't want to have them beyond sometime in the probably mid to late afternoon, depending on your sensitivity. Napping. A lot of people nap, but if you're going to nap, it's best to nap before late afternoon, earlier in the day, and to keep it to maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. If you nap for too long, it sort of deflates your sleep pressure at night when you want to be asleep, and it's harder to fall asleep, and that can get you in a vicious circle.
This was a little terrifying, unsettling as well, is these professions that do not allow you to have a routine. It could be doctors, it could be pilots or cabin crew. In fact, there was some study with a jet-lagged cabin crew who fly on long-haul flights. Parts of their brain actually physically shrunk over time. Their short-term memory was impaired because they couldn't remember things. So it's a roll of the dice, right? If you are in an industry which demands this from you, then it becomes that much difficult. And what does one do? How do we square with that? How do we get around it? Is there a compromise? Can I sleep for 7 hours one day and then 3 hours the next day? Does it work that way at all?
It does not work well that way. And, you know, this is another aspect of sleep being a public problem, a social problem, and not just an individual problem. Some scientists, some sleep researchers have come up with some very effective ways to make shift work less damaging for people. You know, people who work night shifts tend to have a lot of health problems. They have trouble sleeping during the day quite often. Their digestive systems can be messed up, not to mention their social lives and all that. And they can end up falling asleep on the job, even if they get the right amount of sleep, because they're not getting the right kind of sleep. And there are ways to deal with this involving how you schedule the sleep shifts, the night shifts, what hours, how you educate the workers. There are ways of using light exposure, using artificial lighting to help reset people's clocks. But most employers who do have workers on the night shift don't bother with those things. If more employers did, that would help solve the problem. There was a movement in the 1990s to actually have napping be a regular feature of offices. That went out of fashion, but that could also be a helpful thing. There's all sorts of things that really society should be looking into to make it easier on people, because people do depend on their jobs. You know, you've got to do what your boss tells you. Bosses need to pay attention to this stuff too.
Have any of the sleep scientists or the researchers put forth some of their findings which has had a policy change and which has melted the hearts of either bureaucrats or politicians to start making some changes?
Mary Karskatten, she was a student of William DeMent's. Once DeMent started talking about how sleep was a public health issue, his student, Mary Karskatten, was very important in bringing that into our homes and our schools. Karskatten really had never been interested in becoming a scientist, but once she started working in DeMent's lab, he recognized that she was extremely brilliant and talented, and she started getting excited about sleep science. And so Karskatten's made a couple of big contributions. One was that she figured out a tool to objectively measure daytime sleepiness. Before she came along, the only way to know if people were sleepy during the day from not having slept properly the previous night was to ask them, rate your sleepiness on a scale of 1 to 7. And this was not very precise, because different people might have different standards for what constituted a 1, what constituted a 7. Karskatten realized that the way you could really tell how sleepy people were was how quickly they fell asleep when you put them in a dark room, put them in a bed and said, try to fall asleep. She developed a test called the Multiple Sleep Latency Test, or MSLT, which is still the gold standard for measuring sleepiness today. It's used to diagnose things like narcolepsy. It's also used to see how the side effects of sleeping pills are affecting people. It's also used in research to see what different conditions make people sleepy at different times. Karskan then went on to do a long-term experiment called the Stanford Summer Sleep Camp, which was really pivotal in figuring out how children and adolescents sleep. For 10 summers in the 1970s through 80s, she had bunches of kids come into a dormitory at Stanford, and during the day, they would do all sorts of camp things. They would play games, they would play sports, and so forth, but at night and throughout the day, they were being tested on their sleep and their alertness. And what she discovered was something really revelatory. Up until that point, most experts thought that adolescents needed less sleep than younger kids. They were on their way to adulthood. And that the reason that teenagers tended to go to bed so late and sleep so late, as any parent has observed, the idea was that this was not a biological thing. It was because they were staying up late doing homework. They had social lives. It was a social thing. And what Karskadden did in a series of studies was to show that no, actually, there's a biological tendency as kids get into adolescence. They need to go to bed later. They need to go to sleep later. Their brains do not shut down until later at night. And they need almost as much sleep as younger kids, more than adults, and therefore they need to sleep later. And that had big implications about for the way we raise our kids, particularly what time we start school in the morning. So in the United States and many other countries, high schools and middle schools start earlier than elementary schools because it's assumed that teenagers are more mature and therefore they don't need as much sleep. They don't have to, they can get up earlier. Karskadden showed that that's actually the opposite of what kids need biologically. She did studies showing that teenagers suffer great harm from insufficient sleep, depression, substance use, you know, alcohol, tobacco, drugs. And she started doing these studies, and she also showed that it is biological by measuring melatonin levels throughout the 24-hour period in teenagers versus younger kids, and found that their melatonin, which kicks in when you're ready to go to sleep, kicks in later in people's saliva in their teenagers than earlier. Karskadden started publishing on this, she started talking about this. It inspired a movement to start schools later, first in the United States, which has spread to several other countries. And this is something that's, you know, California became the first state in the U.S. to pass legislation that schools should not start before 8:30 a.m. for high school and middle school kids in 2020. And last year, Florida became the second state in the United States, and there are cities around the world that are doing this. So Karskadden has had a great impact on the way we regard sleep in children and adolescents.
Right, because some people are morning larks and night owls is what they call it. So is there an ideal time that you have to sleep at 10 in the night and wake up at 5, or that shouldn't matter as long as you get your, you know, 7 hours, 7 to 9, as you said at the beginning?
So some recent studies seem to be showing that people who do stay up late, you know, past their recommended bedtime, if they are able to sleep in, some of these people, you know, it's actually okay for them because everybody's born with a genetic tendency, sleep tendency, to be a lark or an owl or something in between. I'm something in between. My wife is a definite owl. you know, I wear a sleep, an eye mask while she reads until 2 in the morning so that I can sleep. So a lot of this really is individual. When we talk about how much sleep people will need, we're talking about averages over the population. Different people do have different needs. And one interesting thing that's happened lately is since the pandemic, when a lot of people are doing remote work, that has really, for some of us, has been a blessing because we can set our own hours much more easily than we could when we had to go into an office 5 or 6 days a week. So this may be one of the things that starts happening more in the future. Workplaces will find ways to, in fact, allow employees with different sleep tendencies to sort of customize their own workdays.
Right. In Mumbai, where I live, most of folks travel at least an hour and a half one way. These days, you can work from home more often than not because the pandemic was a great experiment in that. So you just get those 2 extra hours, which if you're smart, probably you might spend them on the bed if you're not getting enough sleep. This was brilliant. Thank you so much, Kenneth. I'm just wondering your research. How long did it take you? How far back did you have to go? There are some things which I tried to look up online to dig a bit more. The only source was you, and it went to the bibliography of your book. You know, what rabbit holes did you have to go through? And, you know, and when did you know, okay, this is enough, let me walk away, and now it's time that I tell a story?
I went down some very, very deep rabbit holes, I must admit. This book took me about 7 years from the time I started doing the preliminary research to the time it was published. And I was doing most of that in my spare time while working as a freelance writer. You know, it might have taken less time if I hadn't been doing other things. But it was a very deep, deep dive. I had to read literally hundreds of scientific studies dating back to the 19th century. Dozens and dozens of books, some of them very old and rare, that I would order online from used book dealers. You know, interviewed about 3 dozen people, experts and people who'd known the characters that I was writing about in the book. So yeah, there was quite a lot of research went into it.
The research papers, with due respect, are not written in a way that is easy to consume. So did that put you to sleep at all?
Sometimes it did. You know, but fortunately, I've been a journalist for a long time, over 30 years, focusing on science for probably the past 10 years or so. And so over time, I've sort of taught myself to read these papers and to see what exciting kernels lurk within that mass of dry scientific language. And so I would be reading things. My wife would come in and look over my shoulder and say, "What is that? It's completely incomprehensible." And I would point to a paragraph and say, "But look at this." So to me, it was exciting.
Yeah, I think there is a rule, right? I read this somewhere, some 30 commandments of writing by some former Guardian editor. He says that if you've got a tangled bowl of spaghetti, don't give the whole thing to the reader. You just pick one strand out, preferably with the vinegar and masala stuck to it, so that they are grateful that you've given them, you know, they don't like complications anyway, the readers. So I think if that were the objective, the book has, you know, come out in that way. I really thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Thanks for writing it.
Well, thanks for reading it. I really appreciate it.